Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can find and explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Octavia E. Butler. Butler was an acclaimed American writer who defied genre, though she is most often associated with the realm of science fiction. The recipient of multiple Hugo and Nebula Awards, she is the author of such classics as Kindred, The Parable of the Sower, Fledgling, and so many more. Butler received a MacArthur Genius Grant and a Penn West Lifetime Achievement Award for her impressive body of work. Her writing is well known, as her official website states, for, quote, her lean prose, strong protagonists, and social observations in stories that range from the distant past to the far future. Today we are joined by Niecy Shaul and Megan Finch. A friend of Octavia's during her Seattle years, author Niecy Shaul is the founder of the diversity and speculative fiction nonprofit, the Carl Brandon Society. Honors received include the Locus, World Fantasy, Otherwise, and Kate Wilhelm Solstice Awards. Megan Finch is an assistant professor in the English department at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. She is currently working on her book project titled Perverse Relations, Madness, Idiocy, and Black Social Life. She is also on the curating team of the American Writers Museum's forthcoming exhibit, Dark Testament, A Century of Black Writers on Justice, opening September 2022. Niecy and Megan are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum.
Well, thanks, Niecy and Megan, for joining me today. I'm excited to talk about Octavia Estelle Butler with you all. Could you first tell me a little bit about yourselves and what you've been up to recently? Niecy, if you'd like to start.
I've been working. just yesterday, I finished an essay about a 6 to 8 story series that I'm working on. I say 6 to 8 because I've written 6 stories and I want to write 2 more about an interstellar penal colony. So there's that. I'm working on revising my draft of my sequel to Everfair. Everfair was the one that was nominated for Nebula, and it takes place in the Congo, and this one starts out in Vietnam, so Hope they're ready for that.
Sounds great. How about you, Megan? What have you been up to?
I wish you wouldn't ask me that after this, because I've been much less productive. I most recently read Niecy's 2043, which I really enjoyed. I'm working on an essay right now, actually, that is trying to think about the missing mothers in kind of post-apocalyptic African-American women's literature. So Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents, as kind of actually 2 missing mothers figure pretty prominently in my thinking there. I'm kind of in the process of moving to Rhode Island, actually, where I'll be a postdoc at Brown, at the Pembroke Center. But normally I'm an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. So
I'm curious how, if you even can recall the first time you encountered Octavia Butler's work, either of you, like what that was like, and just sort of how you first came across her work. For me, it was, I read The Parable of the Sower or 2020. I know, I love reading, but then as the pandemic started, I kind of lost that itch and I couldn't focus, but I picked that one up and I would like snap right back into like, oh yeah, this is why I love reading and these sort of imaginative books. And now I'm reading Kindred now, which is another amazing one. So that's my introduction. She kind of, her words kept me alive a little bit, or like reignited my passion for reading. So I was just like, wow, she's great.
For me, it was actually realizing that I'd read her. I was commissioned to write a biography, an appreciation of her for Fool's Cap, a local science fiction convention. And I looked at her stuff and I was like, oh, wait, I have read this. So It wasn't even that I remember when I read it. I just remember when I remembered reading it.
Yeah.
I think the first time that I encountered Octavia Butler's work was on my field exam list, actually. So I think it would certainly have been Kindred. And kind of reading that in the context of other, and I think I chose that book and didn't on that list read other Butler's work, kind of thinking about it in terms of the neo-slave narrative. And so that was my first encounter with it. And of course, it's very different for obvious reasons from the other neo-slave narratives of the period. And so it was interesting to encounter her work that way. And given my own kind of academic interest, not because of that, choose to read more, not because of like or dislike, but just because, you know, in that it didn't necessarily lend itself to the other kind of things I was doing. And then I re-encountered her work when I started teaching at Rhode Island School of Design. And I decided to teach a class called Black Women Ruin Everything. And I'm not sure, something tells me that actually I was reading Adrienne Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy and reading the way that she engages with Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents. And I didn't have a book list kind of figured out before then. And then I was like, you know, I should go and read that. I think I had a sense that I would do something from Butler. I'd taught Kindred previously. And I was like, maybe I'll look at these and think about whether I can kind of bring in Brown's work throughout the course and then also teach Butler. And that was the second time that I encountered Butler, and I've taught some variation of Sower, Talent, or both together most semesters going forward. And I'll teach them again actually this coming up semester, or at least one of them. Sometimes it's hard to get two novels in when there's a lot of things to do, but
yeah.
Yeah.
the Kindred is usually is most people's introduction to Octavia. So yep. Yeah. Right in there. I think the first thing that I remember reading was Blood Children, which is a short story, very atypical of her work, but gorgeous. Yeah.
You mentioned Blood Children. I was reading the introduction you wrote to the Library of America's collection of Butler's work, and I love that blood symbolism that you were talking about in that introduction. I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
I don't know if I
do remember.
Yeah, no, I think that yes, blood is a sacred substance, and in so many different ways she invokes it. Just the blood of lineage and the blood of the literal blood that's in our bodies, the disease-borne vectors. Yes, all of that. That's all her territory. She made it her territory.
Yeah. So from the introduction, it's after you kind of explain a lot of what you just said, it's I want to find as much of Octavia in her work as I can, her body, her blood. Have I disturbed you? Is what I'm saying too close to blasphemy? Good. I value disturbance as an Octavian quality. I cherish her evocation of it in myself and others. I love that's what I was like, oh wow, God, that's great. I wonder if you could talk about that disturbance and how she kind of unsettles a reader in a way.
Well, I think that she did it by unsettling herself mostly. I think that she did not spare herself I recall her teaching that what you needed to do to write really fantastic literature is to focus on what disturbs you, what upsets you, what gets your goat, and write about that, because that will be a very fruitful topic. And I did try to follow her advice. Yeah.
I wonder if I could ask a question, Nisi, about the choice of, and maybe it's bookending like Kindred and Fledgling, but was there any other kind of choice or kind of rationale behind the choice of having those two novels as the two that are in the collection?
I think that they were just going for the standalone novels, frankly.
Okay.
Yeah. But they are, it is interesting because usually, as I think I said in the introduction, usually Kindred is the way that people first encounter her, and Fledgling was the last way that you could encounter her, because the last novel. So yes, yeah. Book ending is a good way to frame that.
Yeah, I find Fledgling to be such an interesting novel that I think actually came out maybe the same year or very close to the Twilight series, which is just so bizarre to think about these two very different like representations of vampires and the kind of ways in which, like, one of the difficult things I think about Fledgling is the kind of representation of pseudo, but maybe not pseudo, kind of pedophilia, but the way in which obviously that's also actually more accurate in the case of Twilight, insofar as we have like this much bigger actual age gap. So yeah, I was just kind of thinking about where I'm always interested in like Fledgling, the difficulty of reading and teaching Fledgling, and then its proximity to other representations of vampires in the zeitgeist at that time.
So gritty, and yes, again, probably so disturbing. I know of people who cannot read it, who just simply will not read it because of the representation of someone who appears pre-adolescent, and in some ways, even though she's 56, she actually is pre-adolescent. So thank you, Octavia, for shaking us up.
Yeah, which seems to be, I think, something that she does a lot. I was rereading Bloodchild in anticipation of this and kind of thinking about it, actually really trying to, and I haven't gotten anywhere in this thinking, but just thinking about it in relationship to the recent Supreme Court rulings and kind of Ooh. The like shifting to thinking about what does it mean for like an entire race, what does it mean for the entire species to be kind of similarly potentially pregnant. But yeah, I don't know that I have anywhere to go with that other than just the kind of disturbing, the kind of disturbing imagery, right, of pulling out the slugs from that are feeding on this body, and which is also, I think, an interesting way of conceptualizing pregnancy.
Yes. And but what was most disturbing about Bloodchild was the way that all these images of blood and gore were tied to love.
Yeah. And that Butler wasn't afraid to also suggest that love and power are always intertwined. Like, even so, not only thinking about the two character, the kind of two characters who are in love in that, or who seem to be the central romantic figures in that text, but also, you know, one figure has been taking care of this other figure and has been in this other figure's life since it's been a child. So there's, and which is kind of always, and there's the age gaps, I think, that are maybe kind of less, but still a little strange, and like Parable of the Sower, right, where we have Lauren and I can't remember her husband.
I can't remember his name either.
It'll come to me. It's like right on the tip of my mind at the moment. But right, there's like, she's just turned 18 and he's her father's age. And like, so there's always like this kind of, or thinking about the relationship in Dawn, and kind of she, I think one of the things that sometimes we don't always talk about so much in Dawn is that she raised, and again, all their names are escaping from my mind at the moment, but you know, she literally raises the Oncali who becomes her lover in the end, right? And that relationship switches like midway through Dawn. So there's, yeah, I think there's something, and then obviously kind of thinking about Fledgling and the way in which we have a both actually prepubescent in terms of their own development, but also kind of prepubescent in terms of their physicality as, you know, we understand humans. And then, so there's such an interesting way, I think, of going there, like continually going there and requiring us as readers to engage with what that means in the context of the work, right? Like, if it's, and sometimes it's hard to do that, like, and there are reasons to maybe not engage if you can't.
Yes.
But at the same time, like asking us to really think, what does this mean in this particular context with these like varying species and varying levels of power and varying levels of coercion? But yeah, it's a kind of fascinating thing to enter. And I mean, I think it was interesting too, that the way entering, I've actually had a really hard time entering any new work during the pandemic, but I've actually found it really hard sometimes to both important and hard to get into Butler during this period, because I know what I'm gonna get into and I'm not always prepared. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that was a long talk for me.
No, that was great. It's interesting. We've mentioned like her writing is kind of disturbing. We used that word a couple of times. Nisi, you knew her personally. What was she like as Octavia Butler, the person, not the writer? Was she disturbing in person too? No,
not at all. She was the exact opposite of disturbing. She was very soothing, very adapting to her surroundings. She often, I don't think this was an act, she often seemed surprised that people read her books. Hmm. If she met someone and they'd read her things, she would say, "Oh, really?" and one of the few things that actually can still make me tear up is that I realized after she died that she was leading her life in such a way that people would talk about her good when she was gone. Her legacy in so many ways is not just the literature, which is brilliant and gorgeous, and as we said, disturbing, and it really sticks with you. But it's also her interactions on a personal level with everyone around her, with the bus driver, with, you know, the shop attendant, with the waiter. She was always unfailingly gracious. And if she couldn't be gracious, she stayed home.
That's great. How did you meet her in the first place?
Well, as I said, I was commissioned to write a biography and appreciation of her for this science fiction convention, Fool's Cap, where she was a guest of honor, something that they would put in their program. And they paid me by giving me free admission to the convention. So I went, and we were sitting around outside the hotel where the convention was held. And there she was. I recognized her. And what I said to her, which, you know, it was not as much sucking up to her as you would think. I said, "Oh, you're much more beautiful than your photographs." And I think she understood that I was really just talking the truth, not, you know, trying, because after that we were friends. When she moved here, we would like go out to restaurants or plays, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I also liked and you kind of alluded to it, her teaching as well. In the introduction, you list a handful of names who are, you know, still writing today, but the list, I'm sure, is way longer than that of students she impacted with her writing. And I'm curious if you have any insights into her writing process. In the American Writers Museum, we have a beautiful portrait that someone, you know, drew of her. And then one of her quotes is, I'm going to get it wrong, but it's something along the lines of, you start out writing crap. And you got to just get through the crap. And then, but basically it's like, you just got to keep, you know, training that muscle kind of, and just get through the crap and just keep going and going and going. Again, her quote is way better than that, but
She and I have very, very different approaches to writing. But one thing that I know that she did over and over again was write and write and write and throw it out. She went through so many different versions of the sequel to Fledgling. She would sometimes throw out thousands of words and just decide that something was wrong. She had to go in a different direction. This character didn't belong there. This premise was doo-doo. One of the things that she did to sort of prime the pump, as it were, she would listen to news stories on the radio. So I know that that was part of her inspiration, was listening to NPR. she would talk about problems that she was having with me and with other people that she had phone conversations and correspondence with. But mostly she would just like write it, go back and look at it later and say, hell no. I was just going to say that won't do. Her.
You got to appreciate that commitment to start it, but then I got to restart it. Yeah. That's, mm-hmm. I don't know if I have that in me.
Yeah.
You've mentioned, both have how, kind of professionally in both your realms, writing yourself, Niecy, and kind of the more academic and writing as well, Megan, but, you're teaching Octavia Butler's work. I'm curious if you'd like to share what her work and sort of her as a person has meant to you personally, maybe not so much on the professional side, but how has her writing and life sort of impacted your own life?
I don't know that I have a satisfying answer to that. In part, that's just academic training at a certain level, or the kind of academic I've become, which doesn't maybe speak well for the whole enterprise. But I think what I keep going back to Octavia Butler, and I keep going back to one of the things that I've been trying to do in my teaching is to try and think about the world as it kind of feels like it's ending, and to kind of recognize that that is maybe, I don't know how much of that is affect and how much of that is like reality. And it's impossible for me to judge in a way. And so reading and here, I think Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents has been such a kind of touchstone over the pandemic with for various people. And I think with climate change and with incredibly prescient, like make America great again, right? Like whatever she meant there, like it's hard not to, like it always excites me to kind of tell students or to remind students like this thing is so interesting or just like such a, but so what it's meant to me really has been, especially those novels have been a way to try and think about what it means to live after the end, like, and really in particular to kind of what does it mean to try and build community, to engage people in ways that aren't predicated on, you know, having a fire department to put things out, right? Having access to, you know, when you go through that novel and have the police and all of these institutions, how do we engage with one another and build relationships with one another that aren't kind of predicated on the kinds of individualism that are so endemic to like contemporary modern society. And so one of the things I've been trying to do since I started teaching the course that features those texts is kind of end the course in an event that is zero waste and is and that kind of has the students try and really think through how to build these interactions. And the class itself is an exercise in trying to really build those relationships, right? Despite the fact that none of them want to be there, which probably no one wants to be in the apocalypse either. So that's what it is. But it's meant a lot to me because on the one hand, it's hard to keep reading those novels every semester, right? Sometimes I'm like, do I have to? I remember it well enough. I don't need to read it again this time. Like I'm just not in this space. But at the same time, it's meant to me a capacity to think beyond, right? So as at the same time as I'm thinking about like, what have we done, right? I can also, that work has given me a way of thinking about what can we do and what can I do as someone who has so little power in the world? What can I do by just taking 10 people and kind of thinking about community in a way? And that's kind of wholly something that reading those texts has and continues to kind of help me to do. So a lot of times work means like literature to me means work. Like it means like, here's how do I think about what this person was thinking about? But Butler is one of the few authors where it means how do I live?
Yeah. That you brought up community there, that's so important, because that was a common thread throughout her work. And it's something that I find resonance with, and you know, try to emulate that, and to hold up community as a way forward, like she did. I suppose the other things that that she meant to me as a writer, she made. Okay, so when I was on a plane one time, someone asked me what I wrote, and I said feminist science fiction, and they said, "What?" And I said, "Like Octavia Butler," and they said, "Oh, okay." They knew exactly what I was talking about. So she has created in people's minds a space where my work can live, and that's a very selfish way of looking at it. But that is the effect that she has had on my life.
Yeah, those are both great answers. And that your point, Nisi, makes me think, like, what sort of barriers did she have to go through as far as, when she was writing as a Black woman in America? You know, that's, I can't even imagine what doors she had to break down.
And some that she never was able to break down. I think I mentioned in the introduction to that Library of America volume that she had proposed an anthology much like Cherie Renee Thomas's Dark Matter anthology, and could not get backing for it. She wanted to bring together a bunch of science fiction, fantasy, and horror stories by Black people across the centuries, and was basically told, nobody's going to want to read that. And so it didn't happen in her life. Well, it happened when Cherie did it and reprinted some Octavia, but she was not able to knock down that door. So I'm sure they were real. And then, you know, as you have mentioned, I think in your notes, she was dyslexic. Mm-hmm. So she was not just Black, not just female, she was disabled. So plenty of barriers there.
Yeah. You kind of mentioned it with her work kind of being resonant today. And along those same lines, this is maybe, you know, maybe we don't want to surmise here or guess, but like, if she were alive today, how do you think she'd be interacting with our world and all its many, many problems?
I think she'd be really depressed, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't necessarily want to be right about this stuff when you're predicting dystopias, you know?
Right.
I mean, she was already dealing with, there was a real dichotomy in her thinking between, she wanted to write what she called yes stories. I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase, Megan, from reading about her. She wanted to write positive stories because she believed that those would be the ones that people would reach out for, that people would stay with, that would be bestsellers. But she also had a view of humanity as both hierarchical and intelligent that she thought was big trouble. And so all of the stuff with human generated climate change and racism and class warfare and economic destruction of different communities. She, as I said, she listened to the news a lot, and she saw this kind of stuff coming. And I don't think she would have been happy to be right.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I think part of dystopian literature is always to say it so that we can do something about it, right? Even if you, like, and so it's,
right.
I mean, I have to imagine it would be incredibly frustrating, right, to kind of be, here's here's like the obvious outcomes of what we're doing and what we've been doing for centuries. And then, you know, let me, and then to see it happening, right? I'm from California originally. And like, I don't think I would ever, my parents live there. I don't think I would ever go back just because every summer it's on fire. You don't know where you're in. You know, when I was younger, it was mostly in Southern California. And now it's everywhere in California, right? I call my mom and I'm like, is there smoke kind of where you are? Because I don't know, you know, the fire as I get bigger and bigger and kind of thinking about the Yosemite fire right now. And I, you know, I just can't imagine, right?
There's a joke going around. I hang around with a lot of science fiction authors. I mean, that's pretty much my bubble. And one of the jokes is, I didn't mean that as a blueprint. I meant it as a warning. And yeah, I don't know, where would she find comfort? Probably in community.
Yeah, you just mentioned other science fiction as well. Curious, we kind of alluded and mentioned it a little bit, but in what ways do you think she like specifically impacted science fiction writing? And in addition to breaking down the barriers and kind of, like you said, Niecy, like making us create, helping to create a space where writers nowadays can, you know, get published and get their, you know, ideas out there. Are there any sort of like maybe specific like literary techniques that she employed that kind of changed the game a little bit, or anything like that that either of you have noticed in your, you know, studying her and reading her?
The thing that I notice about her, the technique that she employed, well, a couple of things. As I said before, write about things that disturb you. Mm-hmm. And sort of alongside that, the audacity of writing about things that others just kind of ignore and treat as invisible, such as power differentials and how they're invoked when people are questioning someone's abilities because of their race or because of their gender. That audacity, I think, has caught fire, or the people other writers have caught fire with that audacity, I should say.
I don't read enough science fiction, I think, to kind of completely claim the uniqueness of this, but it reminds me, but thinking about the way that the novels and short stories begin, kind of where you feel like you're kind of just thrust into the situation, like thinking about one of the most famous kind of opening lines in literature, that's the last time I went back, like I lost my arm, or that was a paraphrase. Yeah. Don't quote me on that. Or kind of the opening of Sower with I think it starts with probably a verse from Earthseed, if memory serves, perhaps, and then the diary, you know, like I think it's initially about a dream that she's having, you know, I no longer believe in my father's God. And like, you know, you actually encounter her in a dream moment where she's differentiating herself from the religion of her father on her, I think, 15th or 16th birthday. And it reminds me a lot of what Toni Morrison said about kind of getting like that. I think it was something like, I don't want to provide like a kind of waiting room into a text, right? Like,
yeah.
Just getting into it. And so I feel like reading it, and I think there's something especially kind of exciting about that when you're building your own world, right? Because you're like thrusting your reader into the world, and it's also kind of being built there, right? There's something like, and you know, I think this is probably true of other authors as well, but just, you know, it's not even the world which we're kind of familiar with. So there's, or Awake Again, like how dawn begins, I think that's how that one starts or something, and you're just like trying to figure out, and you're like, oh, she's in a ship, and oh, there's been an apocalypse. And so I really appreciate that technique, especially when the worlds that are built are not only so different from our own, but also so different oftentimes from what we might expect of science fiction, right? Because of Butler's, I think, ambivalent engagement with like the kind of technology aspect, right? So it feels like we get a really interesting and unique version of science fiction with Butler.
Yeah. Do you, curious, since we are, you know, the American Writers Museum, like look at the past, and curious if you know or can kind of like guess at some influences of writers who influenced Butler herself. Like I know, Nisa, you said she liked to listen to radio stories a lot. I'm wondering if she was who she was reading a lot as well, or if you can kind of, even if you don't know for sure, I'm sure there's kind of some tendencies you can see as sort of a lineage of writers before her and then writers after. Just curious if you have any insights to the influences on her writing.
She was really influenced by comic books, by superhero comic books. I don't know if you can see that in any of her work. It's pretty obvious, I think, in the sort of Mind of My Mind, Wild Seed kind of thing, where there are people with special telekinetic powers. And I think I saw that sort of trope, I guess you would call it, in science fiction in the 60s and 70s, the early 70s. But it was also a big part of the superheroes in Marvel and DC. She had a huge comics collection, I'm just telling you.
I love that, yeah. My nephew just saw all his dad's old comics in the attic, and so he's been going through them like crazy. So
yeah
I love that. Yeah, because they are, that kind of makes sense. That was very imaginative and kind of fun to read too, so
I know she went to Clarion, and I know that one of her instructors was Samuel Delaney Jr., known to his friends as Chip, who I utterly adore as a stylist, and again, as someone who is audacious in his subject matter. I do not see a lot of similarity in their writing, but I know that Harlan Ellison was also one of her instructors, not at Clarion, but at an earlier workshop that she went to, a script writing workshop, I believe. And again, we have the daring that Harlan Ellison was known for. He's like, he would just go there. And I think that she may have gotten some of that from him.
Yeah, I can see that as well. I think one of the questions I had was, why should people read Butler today? And I think we already covered that pretty well. And I'm curious now is, who today that has been influenced? I mean, I'm sure most science fiction writers at this point have been influenced, most writers have been influenced by Butler, but like who can you see that's kind of carrying on that literary lineage, who's writing nowadays that we should all read as well, and all the new stuff coming out?
Oh, well, those are two different questions. I think about a year after Butler died, I was on a panel called The Next Octavia at a science fiction convention called WisCon, which is a feminist science fiction convention held in Madison, Wisconsin annually. Nora Jemison was on there. I was on there. Tempest Bradford was on there. A bunch of Black women were all like, I'm not the next Octavia because, and then we would go into our various reasons. So in that sense, I don't think that there is someone who is called on to follow in her footsteps, but there are a ton of people who are working in science fiction in ways that she made possible. Well, for one thing, there are all the Octavia Butler scholars, and I'm not talking about like academic scholars. I'm talking about people who have received several thousand dollars to attend Clarion or Clarion West in the name of Octavia Butler. There's Indra Pramit Das, Kai Ashanti Wilson. They're all doing important work. I would look for their work. Karen Gusoff. Every year there are there's at least one, and there are sometimes two. This year there will be three because of stacking up with the pandemic. So those people, I mentioned Kai Ashanti Wilson because I'll mention him again, because one of his short stories, which is available online, The Devil in America, had the same sort of devastating effect on me when I read it that much of Butler's work has had on me. The Devil in America, I have a standing offer. Anyone who reads that, you need to talk to somebody about it afterwards. Give me a call, get in touch with me via email on my website, because that is one, it is a story, a fantasy story that draws on, say, like the Oklahoma massacres, the South Carolina, what was, I can't remember the names of all the towns that have been basically reduced to rubble because of because they were Black successes. Mm-hmm. So read The Devil in America by Kai Ashanti Wilson. Who else would I recommend? Well, me. Yeah.
There you go.
yeah. And gosh, I'm so glad, Megan, that you said you'd read 2043. That's the one about the reparations are finally given to Black people and a bunch of other people. And but they're kind of given and taken away at the same time. The land, the 40 acres are underwater, for instance.
My to be read pile just got bigger, that's for sure.
Oh, and it's narrated by LeVar Burton. So there you go.
Oh.
Yeah. So yes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Megan, do you have suggestions?
There are a ton, but I'm going to recommend one for a specific reason. Usually when I teach Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents, most recently I taught those two novels, and then I posit River Solomon's An Unkindness of Ghosts as the conclusion of that series. And I think in part, I think it depends on how we read the parable novels. I think that there is in those novels a critique of Lauren Olamina that hasn't been maybe talked about quite as much, or at least that's my reading of the novel, is that there's a lot of her father in Lauren Olamina, right? That we have the we have this desire for control, self-control in ways that are very paternal, and in ways that I think the missing mother is really, and the kind of what her mother gave her is a kind of inability to be kind of the self-sovereign subject, right? Insofar as Lauren Olamina feels what she perceives other people to feel, right? And that's and that's kind of, I think, central to a kind of openness that's being, and not one that she wishes on her worst enemies, but one that I think and she talks about this with the death of her brother in the novel, that it's a kind of conscience, right? So like it's a biological conscience. It's just like, don't hurt other people because it has an impact on you, right? Because if she hurts someone, she feels the impact of that. And that I think the novel is on the one hand suggesting is actually the basis of Earthseed, but I don't think Lauren sees it that way, right? Because she is because she sees herself as, you know, as I think her father's daughter. And I think then when we get to the end of Talents, we see this, her brother and herself, right, as two potential endpoints, right? And then we get the Christopher Columbus as, you know, something that she didn't name, but nonetheless, that's what space exploration looks like at that moment. And her own daughter being completely estranged from her. And I think that what, at least as I read River Solomon, I don't think that this is what they intended to do necessarily. But to me, it seems like a novel that thinks about, okay, so when the world ends, right, and the whole, you know, the planet has had to uproot itself, and, you know, I think the Great Lighthouse is what Earth becomes, and then the Matilda is the ship that they're all on, which is instantiated a kind of the kind of worst tendency, and not instantiate, it's kind of codified in a deck system, the worst impulses of parable, the talents, which were kind of beginning to go away, at least in, we're kind of beginning to remedy because the climate was starting to stabilize. At least that's what the daughter says within the novel. I'm sorry, I'm getting so like particular within into the weeds with this. But so I think that one of the things that that novel is thinking about is kind of taking the premise of, or the desire to, that, you know, mankind's destiny is in the stars, and thinking what is maybe left undone in that, or left, you know, what happens if we begin this space exploration, or in fact just need to leave the planet without having maybe, I don't know, work through is probably not the best way of saying this, but with our racist and sexist and ableist and yeah, all of the other isms in place, right? That it results in what we see on the Matilda in An Unkindness of Ghosts. And then we see a kind of, and I would argue in that novel also, we have a kind of missing mother figure who has to be reconnected with, and who in fact is reconnected with, to kind of come up with the ending there. So I think that there's both the kind of picking up of this question that comes up in Parable of the Sower, Parable of the Talents, of like, what happens when the Black maternal line is broken in some case, in these cases, like what happens when the Black mother and the knowledge and the kind of relationship goes missing. And then finally, I think if I read that as River Solomon is kind of concluding that in some ways, like what happens, like what are the possibilities of that reconnection, right? Which is in that novel, maybe I shouldn't say what it is, but in that novel, it's everything, I think. And so I would really recommend River Solomon's An Unkindness of Ghosts and River Solomon in general.
It's definitely in conversation with that. Yeah, yeah, good point.
Yeah, well, I'm getting close to wrapping it up here, but this isn't much of a question, but more just as I was researching Butler's life and work, I didn't realize she had died so young. Only she was 50, you know, late 50s, right? And it's just so impressive to me to have such a body of work that we're still talking about, and like a little bit, you know, sad for sure to not have the unfinished works, you know, like the stuff she was, from what I understand, you know, unfinished trilogy, like Parable is supposed to be a trilogy, right? And so like, it's just, yeah. So again, not much of a question, but just kind of wanted to see if you have any thoughts on that, of the, impressive to me to have such a body of work that has created such a legacy in such an unfortunately short life.
She was so determined. That's what I get from that. And another barrier that she was working against, she had writer's block, something that I have not actually experienced myself. Like I say, we're very different as writers, but she was unable to write for several years, and she attributed that to the blood pressure medication that she was taking. So it could have been more, is what I'm saying. It could have been a lot more, not just because she died so young, but because she was fighting against a writer's block. And what finally broke the block was she just wrote Fledgling, Y'all, for fun. This was her light, frothy, you know, just like, ha-ha. This was like, I believe in this case, she said she was inspired by Laurel Hamilton. So this was like her frothy romance. If you've read it, you know how hilarious that summation is. But she was writing it, I think, for fun. And I think that's what got her over the writer's block, and she should have had more fun.
Oh, well, I've had a lot of fun this conversation. Was there anything else that we didn't touch on that either of you wanted to talk about?
You know, the only other thing I would say is when it comes to classification, I'm not so sure Kindred actually is science fiction.
Yeah.
She would have disputed that. It's more fantasy. And then there are people who say, well, but Fledgling is not horror because it's a vampire, but it's a scientifically plausible vampire. So I think she was someone who was great at messing with our minds and messing with our boundaries.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, because I was reading too, sometimes could kind of get pigeonholed into sort of the Afrofuturism. But that's not right. It's much more than
rolling my eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a great point. Yeah. Even
I would love at some point to have a conversation. I've been trying to do some research just on the Afrofuturism, not like as a, just as a term and the kind of ways that different, I think, Black authors relate to the term or find themselves implicated or not implicated in the term. And I'd be fascinated to kind of hear the story behind that reaction anyways.
Now?
Oh no, maybe at some other point, or you know, if you ever wanted to talk to me again, I would love to pick your brain. But I was also thinking about the kind of ways in which one of the things that's I think fascinating about Butler and maybe is the way that clearly like those genre distinctions don't, you know, especially thinking about that point, I think is so amazing about Kindred is, you know, thinking about the one of the kind of origin points of the neo-slave narrative that happens actually maybe be Styron's writing on Nat Turner, and then kind of the other work that not at all within the genre of science fiction who are writing about that, and then the ways in which on the one hand we have the kind of that fantasy element of time travel that isn't explained by any scientific means, but also as a way of getting kind of thinking about that, the recursive or kind of continuing influence of slavery, but doing so in a very different way than a lot of contemporaries were. Or even one thing I've been really interested in is I think like the issue of flesh that comes up really prominently and like from In Scholarship and Horton Spillers as well as Baby Poppers, maybe and really prominently in that in Morrison's Beloved, but also I think it only shows up, I think, as a term once in Dawn, but I think the idea of flesh there is also really important. And all those works are actually 1987. And so I'm kind of interested in thinking about that as another kind of touch point where at a particular moment in engagement with a lot of Black feminist theorists, right? As well as, you know, even as they're writing in different genres and how that really kind of gives a different entrance point perhaps than kind of thinking about Butler through the lens of science fiction, which is also a necessary component, but.
Thanks again, Niecy and Megan. I had a great conversation. I hope to work with you both in the future. I know, Megan, we, you know, hopefully to see you once Dark Testament opens, our new exhibit.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me to this. It was amazing to get to have this conversation and to meet you.
Yes, I think we could have, you know, done another couple hours of talk, but thank you. Thank you for getting us going on this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening. And to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.